Hello, and welcome back to History's Great Mysteries. I'm your host, Nick, and like I said, it is really good to be back. For those of you who have been following along and listening to each episode, I do apologize for the delay in releasing this episode. Recent world and personal events have taken some priority in my life, and I hope you guys can understand, but honestly, I have to convey my sincerest gratitude to those of you who reached out to me with words of encouragement to continue with this podcast. It genuinely means the world to me, and it has kind of like reinvigorated my motivation to share these incredible stories. So, enough with this happiness, and let's get to the reason why you are all here. The break has given me ample time to prepare a magnificent episode this week, and I don't think you guys will be disappointed. Let me introduce a story that really needs no introduction. Probably the most famous serial killer of all time who has still, to this day, eluded identification. Today, I will cover the legend that is Jack the Ripper. Now, as per usual with these episodes, I will give you a thorough rundown and explanation of the actual event or events, and when you finally have all of the information, I will start laying out the common theories, or in this case, the common suspects, before finally ending with my personal opinion. And through it all, it is my hope that you can formulate your own ideas and opinions about the case. So without further ado, let me set the stage for the infamous serial killer, Jack the Ripper. Now, considering his reputation, it's easy to forget that, all in all, his murders took place over a very short time period, only around 10 weeks in total. The year was 1888 in London, and specifically the murders all took place in an area known as East End, or the Whitechapel District. This area of London during this time offered, let's just say, a much less than ideal quality of life. It was known to be a crime-ridden, violence-filled area of poverty and vices at every corner. And no one from the wealthier West End of London would ever considering traveling to this area. And as a result, police officers feared the area. And as it was described to me, most people didn't even really live in or own houses or flats in this neighborhood. Instead, the poverty-stricken citizens would spend the daytime scrounging or cheating money off the streets in hopes of affording a one-night accommodation in a random bed in these things called lodging homes, where people would literally just buy one bed for one night and hope that they could get the money the next day to buy another bed. So I'm sure you get the picture. It's an extremely rough, dirty place, and for the most part, it was regarded as like the seedy underbelly of England. And those with a little bit more wealth, anywhere from like the middle class all the way up to the royalty of England, would rather turn a blind eye to the atrocities that were happening at East End rather than offer any kind of assistance. Still, though, London was known around the world as a place of opportunity. And for poor immigrants, East End, unfortunately, was really their only option to move into. As a result, the population was ever growing, and the animosity between the native English people and the immigrants were also growing. So needless to say, there was a lot of underlying anti-Semitism going on at this point. Now, like I said, all of these problems in East End were ugly, and the rest of England elected to sweep these problems under the rug. At least that is, until they were forced to pay attention. For in the later half of the year of 1888, a serial killer would strike fear into the hearts of the world and shed light on the problems at Whitechapel. Before I jump into the actual murders that occurred, it's important to recognize that not all historians agree upon the number of victims. Generally, it's agreed that there were definitely five, and these victims are known as the canonical five, but there could have been up to 11 victims. And how did they decide this, you may ask? Well, as you're about to discover, Jack the Ripper had a very specific MO, an MO that points to specifically only five victims. If you are to believe that he strayed away from his MO for other victims, then sure, you could be one of those people that believes there were more murders. But to keep things consistent and to go along with what most Ripperologists agree on, I will keep the podcast focused on the five canonical victims. Now, let's establish this right now. All five of them were women, All five of them were between around 20 and 45 years old. And lastly, all five of them were sex workers. As it will become apparent, Jack the Ripper intentionally sought out prostitutes, and we will go into why that may be a bit later. So the first event occurred late on the night of August 30th, 1888. A sex worker named Mary Nichols was out and about on that night. Her timeline is fairly well known. Around midnight, she was seen leaving a pub quite intoxicated, where she eventually made her way to a local lodging house in hopes of finding a bed to sleep on for the night. However, upon arrival, she was turned away simply because she didn't have enough money. So she went back out onto the streets and was seen around 2:30 a.m. roaming around, apparently looking for a way to make the money she needed. Her friend, a woman named Emily Holland, remembers speaking to her briefly, noting that she was still intoxicated before parting ways shortly thereafter. Emily would be the last person to see Mary alive, for it was around 3:40 a.m. that a man by the name of Charles Cross was walking to work in the dark when he noticed a strange shape slumped in a gateway. As he walked closer to inspect it began to take the shape of a woman. According to Mr. Cross's statement, he bent over the body, not sure what to make of the scene. He couldn't tell if the woman was passed out drunk or dead. Then he heard footsteps coming towards him down the street, footsteps that belonged to another man on his way to work named Robert Paul. Mr. Cross called Robert over, saying, "Come over here, there's a woman lying on the pavement." The two men inspected the body, not sure what to make of it. Again, it's only 4 in the morning at this point, and there's little to no lighting along the street. It's pitch black dark, and they can barely make anything out. But upon touching the body, Robert Paul remarks that it is cold, and he fears that she is dead. Not wanting to be late for work, the two hurry off down the street, agreeing that they will flag down a policeman on their way and tell them what they found. Sure enough, Cross stumbles upon a policeman, John Neal, who hurries over in the direction that he has pointed to investigate. Neal is met with a truly ghastly sight, a sight to which he calls immediately for backup and an ambulance. At this point, Neal can tell that her throat has been slit. And I apologize for the graphic nature, not only of this description, but of all future descriptions of the murders. But I do believe that the details are very pertinent to the case. But in any event, her throat was slit so harshly that the cut was almost all the way down to the bone of her spine. Soon thereafter, a medical examiner named Dr. Llewellyn arrives on the scene. His reports say that upon his arrival around 4 a.m., that the girl had been dead for around 30 minutes. This means that when Cross arrived at 3:40, the murder had really truly just occurred. Word spread quickly in this area, and by morning it seemed that all of East End knew about this grisly murder. The police did their due diligence, and the hunt was on for the murderer, but no one knew that this was only the beginning of a truly horrific killing spree. It was only 9 days later that another sex worker, Annie Chapman, was roaming the streets of East End in an eerily similar manner to that of Mary Nichols. She was a bit short on money late at night and couldn't quite afford a bed at a lodging house. So, with remarks that she will be back shortly, Annie went back onto the street to collect the money she needed. It wasn't long before Annie did indeed find a man that was evidently interested in her services. This was reported by an individual who was walking along the street at around 5:30 in the morning. This witness reports that Annie was standing, talking to a man in a black hat and a black overcoat. Apparently, only a couple sentences were overheard between Annie and the mysterious man. Apparently, he asked, "Will you?" and she replied, "Yes." Now, this witness only saw the man, who almost certainly was Jack, from behind. The individual couldn't get a clear look at the man's face, but would later tell police that the man appeared to be quote-unquote foreign, or an immigrant. It was only 30 minutes later, at 6 in the morning, when an elderly man walked out of his apartment complex to see the body of Annie Chapman strewn out on the ground. Now, again, this is going to be a quite graphic description, because with the Ripper's second victim, Annie Chapman, his murdering definitely evolved in a more gruesome direction. A police report from the scene describes the body like this. The left arm was placed across the left breast, the legs were drawn up, the feet resting on the ground, and the knees turned outwards. The face was swollen and turned on the right side. The tongue protruded between the front teeth, but not beyond the lips. The tongue was evidently much swollen. The body was terribly mutilated. The stiffness of the limbs was not marked, but was evidently commencing. He noticed that the throat was dissevered deeply, that the incisions through the skin were jagged and reached right around the neck. In addition to this, the abdomen had been completely cut open, with intestines strewn out and draped across the shoulders of the body. Hours later, it would be discovered that within the opening at her abdomen, her entire uterus had been cut out and removed and then carried off by the murderer. The doctor that performed the inspection also publicly noted that the cuts around the body, most notably of the uterus, and in the small time frame that it was done and completely in the dark, indicated to him that the killer must have anatomical knowledge, and also probably some experience with surgery. Now, I'm going to go into my own personal theory later, but I feel I need to point something out. This specific comment by the doctor completely altered the trajectory of the investigation. From here on out, the police were absolutely convinced that they were looking for a doctor or a surgeon or a butcher or something in that regard. And still to this day, that seems to be the prevailing belief. And when I was first researching this case, I didn't want to take that just on the surface level and just be like, yeah, of course it was a doctor. I really wanted to look into it. And through looking through the case files of Annie Chapman's murder and then the consequential murders after that, it just seemed that, yeah, there was definitely purpose with how the Ripper was cutting open things and how he was taking things off. It seemed very driven, but I wasn't so convinced that it was immediately like, yep, it had to be a doctor, someone with surgical experience. And what I'll come back to time and time again as I explain this case is that a lot of times I think that one big assumption, if it's wrong, can completely derail finding the murderer. Right, and there's a lot of assumptions made in this case. And so if you just take one thing and say, okay, maybe this assumption was wrong, it opens up thousands of suspects that were never thought of before. And the police from here on out, like I said, were really convinced that it was a doctor. And so they eliminated like 100 people that could have very well been Jack and then opened it up to 100 new people that were never thought of before. And I'm not saying that this assumption was wrong. It is very possible that this guy did have anatomical knowledge, but what I'm saying is that as I explain this case to you, please keep an open mind to everything that I tell you, because any assumption could be wrong, and rethinking an old assumption could be the way that we find out finally who Jack is, thinking of somebody that maybe was never thought of before. So anyways, I'm going to read this quote to you just to solidify exactly how you guys feel about this doctor claiming that there was surgical knowledge. So here it is. From the pelvis, the uterus, and its appendages, with the upper portion of the vagina and the posterior two-thirds of the bladder, had been entirely removed. No trace of these parts could be found, and the incisions were cleanly cut, avoiding the rectum and dividing the vagina low enough to avoid injury to the cervix uteri. Obviously, the work was that of an expert, of one at least, who had such knowledge of anatomical and pathological examinations as to be enabled to secure the pelvic organs with one sweep of the knife. And again, to remind you, he did this in complete darkness. And so, that's what the doctor said of that case with Annie Chapman. So I encourage you to make your own assumptions about whether or not, yeah, this had to be a doctor, or maybe it didn't. But in any event, back to the situation at hand. After the murder of Annie Chapman, people and police were beginning to realize that they might have a big problem on their hands, a problem that was willing to strike again and again. At this point, newspapers were beginning to pick it up, mostly because of the truly grisly nature of these crimes, and because the killer was still on the loose. People didn't know what to call this new killer. Some newspapers were calling him the Whitechapel Murderer, and some were calling him the Leather Apron Killer. And this was because at the murder scene of Annie Chapman, a leather apron was found nearby, which got a lot of people thinking. More specifically, the local prostitutes in the area immediately had a suspect in mind. A man who had given them some hard times in the past. A man who had been known to wear a leather apron. A man named John Pizer. Police immediately followed up this tip and arrested Mr. Pizer. He, however, was kind of expecting the police. He acknowledged that, yes, he did have a past of crime, and yes, he did wear a leather apron for his job, but he absolutely denied being the Whitechapel murderer. Of course, police had to press him further, and after some investigation, it was found that Mr. Pizer did indeed have rock-solid alibis for his whereabouts during the two murders, meaning that he could absolutely not be the killer. This disheartened the public, who desperately wanted the killer to be apprehended. The public's interest and desire for an arrest was strong, but as was typical of the English government at this point, they elected to turn a blind eye to the events at East End. To a certain extent, this infuriated the locals of the area and then baffled the other citizens of England, who were not used to this type of neglect from the higher-ups. I mean, there wasn't even a reward being offered for information on the murders, which was very commonplace at the time. So again, everyone knows of what's going on, yet the government is doing nothing. And as a result, some citizens banded together and formed a committee to watch and protect the streets of East End. This group was led by a man named George Lusk, whom will become an important figure later. The area of Whitechapel was now on high alert, with police and citizens actively patrolling the streets day and night. Almost a month goes by without any sign of the killer, and people eventually started to lighten up, and maybe even think that the murders have stopped. However, on September 27th, the Central News Agency of London received a mysterious letter written entirely in red ink. This letter has gone down in history ever since then, and many believe that it really was sent by Jack the Ripper, and I'll read it to you now. "Dear boss, I keep on hearing the police have caught me, but they won't fix me just yet. I have laughed when they look so clever and talk about being on the right track. That joke about Leather Apron gave me real fits. I am down on whores and I shan't quit ripping till I do get buckled. Grand work the last job was. I gave the lady no time to squeal. How can they catch me now? I love my work and I want to start again. You will soon hear of me with my funny little games. I saved some of the proper red stuff in a ginger beer bottle over the last job to write with, but it went thick like glue and I can't use it. Red ink is fit enough, I hope, ha ha. The next job I do, I shall clip the lady's ears off and send the police officers just for jolly, wouldn't you? Keep this letter back till I do a bit more work, then give it out straight. My knife's so nice and sharp, I want to get work right away if I get a chance. Good luck. Yours truly, Jack the Ripper." And then in postscript wrote, "Don't mind me giving the trade name. Wasn't good enough to post this before I got all the red ink off my hands. Curse it, no luck yet. They say I'm a doctor now. Ha ha." And yes, it was in this letter that the killer gave himself the name Jack the Ripper. Needless to say, the name stuck. And now, like I said, there's no definitive proof that this letter was indeed sent by the killer, but it is very possible. Nowadays, we hear about this kind of thing a lot, and we see it in movies and whatnot. But I cannot stress this enough. At this point in history, no serial killer had ever really done this before, sending, you know, correspondence and taunting the police. And some point to this is an indication that, yes, this really was Jack, while some say, no, this was just a fake, an attempt by the news agencies, maybe, to hype up the story. Either way, there are a few interesting things that I would like to point out about this letter, if we are to believe that it is from Jack the Ripper. Firstly, the bit about the ears is oddly specific, and you'll see in a bit if the prediction actually panned out. Secondly, if we are to believe that this guy really is medically trained, then how the hell did he not know that blood congeals? Like, you heard him complain that he wanted to write the letter in blood, but that it got all thick and gluey. And this is kind of a contradiction. It doesn't really make sense. Like, if he's medically trained, why does he not know that the blood would congeal? And then lastly, he says that he wants to get back to work right away, which indeed actually ends up happening, as only 2 days later, Jack the Ripper was back on the streets with his most vile act yet. It was the night of September 29th that the infamous double event occurred. The first victim, a woman named Elizabeth Stride, was working the streets as normal. This night is very important because there are several eyewitness sightings of Elizabeth Stride with a man who almost certainly was Jack the Ripper. The first sighting was at 11 p.m. with rain falling down, when two men recall seeing Elizabeth sheltering in a doorway. It was said that she was standing next to a man, roughly 5'5", wearing all dark clothing, and with a mustache. Apparently, they were kind of embracing and kissing, and it's also noted that the two men actually made a passing joke that the fella could be anyone, even the Leather Apron. Another sighting by a different witness 45 minutes later would tell a similar story of a 5'5 man in dark clothing and in an embrace with Elizabeth Long is actually a different character. This witness was also able to overhear the man say one sentence to Elizabeth, which was, "You would say anything but your prayers," which is very eerie indeed. At 12:30 a.m., a policeman actually walked by and witnessed the two still talking close together, but he didn't see anything out of the ordinary, so he kept going on past them. And lastly, there was yet another final eyewitness who may have actually seen the beginnings of the murder. His name was Israel Schwartz, and he tells the story that he was walking down the street when he noticed the man and Elizabeth Stride in a bit of a tussle. Apparently, the man spun Elizabeth around and threw her on the ground, at which point Elizabeth cried out. Israel, who thought he was witnessing domestic abuse, scurried away from the scene as fast as he could as to not get involved. This sighting by Israel occurred at 12:45 a.m., and only 15 minutes later, a man named Lewis was in a horse-drawn cart when the horse would no longer move forward for some reason. He jumped off his cart and investigated. On the ground in front of the horse, he could faintly make out a dark mass. It was very dark, and so he whips out a match to light the scene. And this match only stayed alight for a few moments before quickly being extinguished by the wind. But in that moment of light, Lewis saw a petrifying sight. Indeed, Elizabeth Stride had been murdered, and now she lay on the cobblestone with blood everywhere. Now, here's where things really get unique. Upon police and doctors arriving on the scene, they quickly realized that this must be the work of Jack the Ripper, due to the person, place, time, and the fact that the throat was cut. But that was all. Elizabeth had not been torn open like Annie Chapman was. What's more, the doctor remarked that Elizabeth had died between 12:50 and 1 a.m., based on the still warm blood and limbs. What most historians maintain is that when Lewis came around in his cart, he actually interrupted Jack mid-act. Even though Lewis couldn't see anything in the dark, what most likely happened is that Jack heard him coming, left Elizabeth on the ground, and then slunk back into the shadows for a quick getaway. However, it would become painfully obvious that this unsatisfying kill, if you may, was not enough for Jack. He needed more, and he could not leave it at that. It was only 45 minutes later that yet another body was found only blocks away. This was the body of yet another prostitute, Catherine Eddowes. Catherine had just been released from the police station after spending a few hours in the drunk tank, sobering up from a night of intoxication. It was thought that when she was released, she would make the short 8-minute walk back to her lodging house, but she never arrived. Instead, it was around 1:35 a.m. that Catherine was seen walking with a man whom, you guessed it, was around 5'5", dark clothing, and a mustache. Only 10 minutes later, a police officer turned a corner and, through the light of his lantern, laid his eyes upon the desecrated body of Catherine Eddowes. She was completely torn up, much like Annie Chapman, with entrails flinged over her shoulders and a portion of her kidney missing. And also, get this, portions of her ears had been removed as well. By the time the police found her, the murder was very recent. There was pandemonium in the streets of East End as both policemen and committee members were scrambling, trying to track down the killer who must still be close by. It was about an hour later that the first and only real clue of all of the murders was found. In an alleyway at the foot of a doorway, a piece of an apron was found upon the ground, drenched in blood. It was the police's assumption that this piece of apron was used to wipe down the knife and then was left behind. Furthermore, directly above the apron piece on the stone wall was writing in chalk that read, "The Jews are the men that will not be blamed for nothing." And there's much debate among Ripperologists about what all of this means. Some say that the apron was left on purpose to taunt the police, which could also be why the chalk writing was left behind, apparently identifying himself as a Jewish man. But some say there's no proof that the writing was actually Jack's, and it's possible that the writing had been on the wall for weeks now. Either way, when the police found this, they made an executive decision to erase the chalk writing, fearing that it would only stoke the fire of anti-Semitism in the area even further. So when the dust settles, 4 women have been murdered, the most recent 2 in the same night, and Jack the Ripper still somehow eludes capture. There are many reports about how baffled police and citizens were that this murderer could operate so silently in public, so close to people walking just blocks away, and then run off without being seen. Some speculate that the big coat he was wearing served to hide the blood-stained clothing underneath it, as Jack almost certainly would remove the outer coat before murdering the women. This meant that he could leave the crime scene, put the coat on, and then look like a completely normal pedestrian with no blood showing anywhere. And also, many of the doctors were adamant that he strangled his victims first before slitting the throat, meaning that blood spurts and then, like, you know, getting drenched in blood wasn't really known. Like, he might actually just be walking around with relatively little blood upon him. And then I would also like to point out that it was the next day, October 1st, that the newspapers finally released publicly that Dear Boss letter that I read to you a bit ago. And no one really talks about this, but, like, let's use some logic here. Someone writes to the news agency claiming that they're Jack the Ripper, and to prove it, they're going to remove the ears of their next victim. But the letter's not made public. A couple days later, when Jack has time to spare with his second victim, ears are indeed clipped away, something that he had never done before. So 2 + 2 = 4, right? The letter had to have been from the real Jack, because if the public was, you know, not made aware of the ear-cutting threat until after Catherine Eddowes was murdered, and it turns out, yep, her ears were cut off, then, you know, bam, there you have it. It had to be Jack. He told them that he would cut the ears. Only he and a couple people at the news agency knew about this threat, and then it happened, which, you know, makes the assumption made from the letter all that much stronger. You know, if we can really believe that that letter was from Jack, then all of the things that he said in the letter now can be used as further assumptions to drive the case, you know, further and find the right suspect. It was 5 days later, on October 6th, that a second letter came in from a man claiming to be Jack. This letter read, "I was not codding, dear old boss, when I gave you the tip. You'll hear that Saucy Jackie's work tomorrow, double event this time, number one squealed a bit, couldn't finish straight off, had not the time to get the ears for police. Thanks for keeping last letter back till I got to work again. Jack the Ripper." However, it's worth mentioning at this point, with the first letter being public, the news agencies were being flooded with fake letters written by bored citizens across the country. So from this point on, it's hard to distinguish which letters are actually him. Although the one letter I read you does have some credibility due to it matching the writing style of the first letter. So you have to also acknowledge that all of the information is public, like all of the information of the murders is being released publicly through the newspapers, so everyone has details. So that second letter that I just read you doesn't necessarily give details that not everyone else knew. It was only the writing style that really matched them. It was 10 days later that the old chap I mentioned earlier, George Lusk, who headed the Citizens Committee, got some mail of his own. This letter or package was delivered, quote unquote, from hell, and contained a piece of a kidney. Now, if you remember, Catherine Eddowes did indeed have a piece of a kidney missing. Mr. Lusk immediately had it examined, and this is where things get a little bit hairy. Everyone had their own opinion on whether or not this kidney did belong to Catherine. It seems that most doctors agreed, yes, it was a human kidney, but most agreed that it was probably a joke, like a medical student's cruel joke, sending this kidney from a lab rather than from the real Jack. And I honestly kind of share this opinion, in that the writing that accompanied the kidney did not match at all in writing style, spellings, etc., of what was believed to be real Jack the Ripper writings. It's also worth pointing out that this was days after the Catherine Eddowes murder, and again, all of the details have been made public. Everyone knew that she was missing part of her kidney, so it's not unreasonable to think that someone had the idea to pull off this sick prank. And this will bring me to the final event of the timeline, the fifth canonical murder, that of Mary Kelly. This occurred on November 9th, and the day began normally enough. Mary Kelly was staying in a rented apartment building where she was planning to take a man back to and make money that night. Apparently, she was last seen alive walking towards the apartment building with a man next to her. The eyewitness of this account, George Hutchinson, manages to linger around the pair and to get some good details about the man. He was apparently suspicious because he followed them for quite a while, and as they were passing under a streetlight, he managed to get a good look at him. He didn't recognize him, but as per the police statement, Hutchinson said the man appeared to be around 5'6", mid-30s, pale complexion, mustache turned up at the corners, and of quote-unquote Jewish appearance. It is at around 3 a.m. that the pair walk into Miss Kelly's apartment, and Hutchinson can no longer follow them. At around 4 a.m., neighbors of Miss Kelly awoke to the cries of murder. But apparently at this time and place, that wasn't all that uncommon, and people would cry out murder for like any old brawl. So the neighbors didn't really think much of it and went back to sleep. It wasn't until 10:45 a.m. that an owner of the building knocked on Mary Kelly's door to collect rent. When there was no answer, he peered in through the window to see something that would stay with him forever. Mary Kelly had been murdered and mutilated terribly. This was hands down Jack's most gruesome murder. And I'll save you the nitty details, but again, throat cut, abdomen open, entrails everywhere, pieces of flesh lying about, blood everywhere. And there's actually quite a haunting quote from the individual who had first found her there, and it's this: "The sight that we saw, I cannot drive away from my mind. It looked more like the work of a devil than of a man. I heard a great deal about the Whitechapel murders, but I declare to God I had never expected to see such a sight as this. The whole scene is more than I can describe. I hope I may never see such a sight as this again." At this point, a full-on frenzy has begun in the country and the world over, as tales of Jack the Ripper and East End work their way into everyone's nightmares. The people were absolutely on edge, and again, also frustrated that the police and the government seemed hopeless to ever catch this murderer. But lo and behold, first weeks go by, and then months, and then years, and no real Jack the Ripper type murder was ever seen again. And sitting here now, looking back at it all, many historians agree that this is where Jack hung up his coat. Now, why did he stop killing, you may ask? Well, that depends on who you think the killer was in the first place. So with that, I will introduce some of the most well-known and credible suspects in the case of Jack the Ripper, after which I will talk and offer my own opinion on who this man could have possibly been. And also, as I talk about the suspects, remember to form your own opinion and keep in mind that any of the assumptions in this case could be misguided, like that the killer was a doctor, or that the killer was foreign, or that the letters were real, and that changing any of these assumptions drastically changes who the killer could be. So keep that in mind as I begin with the names, and also rest assured I am only giving you guys suspects that legitimately could be Jack the Ripper. A lot of resources when I looked, I was researching this, would list suspects and then at the very end be like, oh, but this guy was in prison during the Whitechapel murders, so it seems unlikely that he was the killer. Like, yeah, of course, that seems very unlikely. So yeah, I'm really only giving you guys thoroughly vetted names and possibilities. The first suspect I'll talk about is a name you've actually heard before. Charles Cross. Do you remember him? He was the man who stumbled upon the first murder, the murder of Mary Nichols. At least, that's what he told police. There are some that believe he was really Jack the Ripper, who got cut short on his first murder. Because if you'll remember, Charles Cross gave the statement to police that he was leaning over the body when another man, Robert Paul, came walking down the street. Perhaps Charles was really hoping to continue with the mutilation when he was interrupted, and then played the whole scene off like he had found her like that. Charles was about the right age and build, and he had lived in the area for years, which would give him the ability to slink in and out of alleyways to make quick escapes and evade detection. It is also known that Charles did indeed give police a fake name when they later questioned him, which leads people to be even more suspicious. And for me, this is a tough one because, yeah, a lot of things do line up, but there's one important detail that makes me think Charles is not the killer. And this is because of what the second man that night, Robert Paul, said about the body. If we were to believe that Charles really had just murdered Mary Nichols, like just got done murdering her, and then was interrupted by Paul, then we would have to believe that the body would still be worn upon his arrival, right? But no, when Robert was giving his statement, he was adamant that the body was cold to the touch, and that right there means to me that he at least, there was like at least a good chunk of time since the actual murder, meaning that it's unlikely Charles was our Jack. And I suppose it's possible that when the murder was carried out by Charles, supposedly, he could have just meandered around a while, allowing time for the body to cool, and then that's when Robert came in. But all in all, I still maintain my belief. And another thing that's missing with this suspect is a motive or a link to any kind of insanity. A second name I'll give you is that of Dr. Francis Tumblety. Yes, as the name implies, this was a man in the London area of the time of the murders who did indeed have an advanced anatomical knowledge, and also had less than encouraging background. Some of his close peers would talk about his supposed hatred of women and his odd collection of body parts. Even some of the top detectives in London working on this case at the time felt strong about Dr. Tumblety's guilt, enough to have him arrested. However, it looks like the police never really had enough to book him, and from there, Dr. Tumblety began a game of cat and mouse, evading further arrests by traveling, giving fake names, etc. Listen to this excerpt. He was arrested on November 7th, 1888, on charges of gross indecency and indecent assault with force and arms against four men between July 27th and November 2nd. These eight charges were euphemisms for homosexual activities. Tumblety was then charged on suspicion of the Whitechapel murders on the 12th, suggested he was free to kill Kelly between the 7th and 12th. Tumblety was bailed on November 16th, a hearing was held on November 20th at the Old Bailey, and the trial postponed until December 10th. Tumblety then fled to France under the alias Frank Townsend. And it seems a bit weird to me that the murders stopped right after he fled to France, doesn't it? And then, even though this seems like a perfect fit, it is true that a lot of the speculation against him is pure hearsay, which casts doubt over everything. More so, Dr. Tumblety did not match physically the description of Jack. And in this one, there's just too many question marks for me to be truly convinced. Another name for the suspect of Jack the Ripper is George Chapman. And this guy is interesting to say the least. George was born in Poland, making him fit the immigrant description, who trained as a surgeon before moving to London in 1887. Equally as suspicious, he also fit the physical descriptions given by eyewitnesses at murder scenes. Going further, Mr. Chapman was actually a known and convicted criminal later in his life, so much so that he was actually hanged in 1903 for killing several of his wives through poisoning. A remark made in testimony by one wife actually claims this. She states that on one occasion, when she had a quarrel with her husband, he held her down on the bed and pressed his face against her mouth to keep her from screaming. At that moment, a customer entered the shop immediately in front of the room, and he got up to attend to him. The woman chanced to see a handle protruding from underneath the pillow. She found to her horror that it was a sharp and formidable knife, which she promptly hid. Later, Chapman deliberately told her that he meant to have cut her head off and pointed to a place in the room where he meant to have buried her. This shows that he also had not only the capacity to kill, but maybe that he was, and he was, you know, more than a bit unhinged, but also that he felt confident in killing with a knife. Furthermore, Chapman did live in the immediate vicinity of the Whitechapel murders during the correct time. And sure enough, in 1891, only a short time after the murders, Chapman moves to America. And this is when the murders stopped, right? People always questioned whether or not a true vicious mutilator could change his MO and kill using poison all of a sudden. And honestly, yeah, I could buy that. I mean, maybe he still wanted to kill, but the days of running bloody through alleyways were behind him. And as far as detractors for the case against Chapman goes, there really aren't many. Maybe one solid detractor is that many eyewitnesses claim to have heard Jack the Ripper conversing quite a bit with the women, and it's hard to believe that this Polish-born man was able to master the English language to this extent less than a year after moving to England, but maybe. And the last name I'll give you is Aaron Kosminski. Now, Aaron Kosminski is a popular name to throw around for ripperologists, as many view him as a very strong suspect, and that is for several reasons. Firstly, he indeed had a very tragic backstory growing up in Warsaw, Poland during an era of violence. So yes, he does have slight reason to grow up unstable, and also yes, he was indeed foreign. So his family eventually moved to England, where they struggled. Kosminski has a rough description as a barber during this time, but it's thought that he mostly lived jobless on the street. And it is known, though, that his dad was a doctor, which is where he could have gained some amount of anatomical knowledge to pull off these murders. Furthermore, it is also known that he held a hatred for women, and later historians would diagnose him with paranoid schizophrenia, which could account for some of these unthinkable actions. Although they certainly knew he was mentally unstable back then, too, as he was locked up in an asylum in 1889. And 1889, the murders stopped right about then, didn't they? But Kosminski was in his mid-20s at the time of the murders, in contradiction with many of the accounts that Jack was in his 30s or 40s. So what do you think? Are you convinced of anything? Because I'm about to give you who I personally think must really truly be Jack the Ripper. Now, I didn't take this decision lightly, and I really did a lot of soul-searching before I came down to a name. And again, let me just give you a rundown of my assumptions thus far. I do believe that the person had to be local, because how else would they have been able to dodge police, jump in and out of alleyways, go in and out of buildings with such ease? They had to be comfortable there. In my mind, they had to know the area. And again, all of these murders took place in the same like 5 blocks. And so to me, that means they had to be local. I do think they had to have some sort of medical knowledge, at least a little bit. I think there was a purpose when Jack the Ripper was opening abdomens. I think there was no time to waste. I think he did, you know, really purposeful cuts. But to say that he absolutely had advanced knowledge and he had to be a surgeon, I think, is a bit of an overstatement in my mind. Because again, he's cutting out parts of livers and you know, strewing out all these internal organs to get to something. Like, I think he had some knowledge, but I don't think he was an expert surgeon. And again, he did all of this in like 15 minutes. He had to go fast, so he didn't have time to, you know, think about where he's going to cut and make multiple cuts, which would have looked more unprofessional. So I think there's a little bit of a misunderstanding there, at least in my mind. But I do think he had some sort of medical knowledge, or anatomical knowledge, that is. I think he at least had to fit some of the physical descriptions, or else, like, you know, we have all of these eyewitnesses giving the exact same kind of person over and over again that had to be Jack. And I think if you're talking about somebody that doesn't look like that, you just kind of have to erase them. So that, in my mind, it had to fit that as well. And then also there had to be some sort of reason, some sort of motive, or some sort of insanity that went along with this person. It couldn't have just been a random guy that seemed to be okay, you know what I mean? Like, and there had to be a reason. There had to be some sort of women hatred. There had to be some sort of reason that he was targeting specifically prostitutes. And all of these assumptions to me led to Aaron Kosminski. That is who I think Jack the Ripper was. Again, we have that tragic backstory growing up in like a very violent era in Poland, where he apparently saw people being killed. He had a very, very rough childhood, which could have, you know, stunted and made him unstable as he grew into adulthood. He had a dad who was a doctor who was really supporting the family, so maybe he looked up to his father and learned from him a little bit, enough to have this anatomical knowledge that he needed to carry out these murders. When he did get to London, he struggled. He apparently was found many times like eating food out of gutters, and it's possible that his mental instabilities and his maybe hatred towards women also brought him to choose prostitutes as his victims. Again, we have these people that are saying over and over again that the guy had a foreign appearance, and you know, think of that as you will, and it's probably not right for that to have been said, but at the end of the day, Aaron Kosminski, in the police reports, was said to also have a very foreign appearance, so at least on that level, he is matching descriptions. Yes, he didn't technically match descriptions of age, but I think that's something that could easily have been overlooked. Someone can look much older, and especially if they're dirty and maybe a little bit, you know, homeless, they can look older than they really are, I think. Secondly, we have to talk about recent DNA findings that actually point to Kosminski. So there's this shawl that was found at the murder of Catherine Eddowes. Apparently she was wearing the shawl. And unavoidably, DNA of the murderer had to have been on that shawl. But back then, they didn't have DNA. They couldn't do DNA research to find the killer. But nowadays, we can. So recently, in about 2007, the shawl was purchased and studied for any kind of DNA that could link anybody to the crime. And it is true that DNA, mitochondrial DNA, did match a distant Kosminski relative. So we have a living Kosminski relative that has matched DNA on the shawl found with Catherine Eddowes. And a lot of people want to discredit this research. I will be very outright with that. A lot of people say that it can't be scientifically like backed up. The journal that it was originally posted in, there was very little actual scientific evidence behind it. There was a purpose to why they wanted it to be Kosminski. They were really trying to get to the bottom of it. It wasn't peer reviewed originally. Also, there's not a ton of evidence that the shawl was actually there, that it actually was Catherine Eddowes' shawl. Many people, there's reason to think it was, but there's not definitive proof that it was. Furthermore, over hundreds of years, that shawl has been touched by so many hands, and the DNA linkage wasn't 100%. It was like, oh, it like kind of matches a relative of Kosminski, but through hundreds of hands and through many years and generations, it could be linked to a lot of people, you know? And so it doesn't, it by all means, the DNA thing doesn't directly link Kosminski, but it kind of indirectly links Kosminski, which is a little bit of a strong suspicion for me. Secondly, or thirdly, police during the time of Jack the Ripper murders did arrest Kosminski on suspicion of being Jack the Ripper. And that, you know, obviously the police were suspecting him. And we actually have, and this is probably the strongest thing for me, he was actually at one point put into a police lineup where an eyewitness who saw Jack picked him out of the police lineup and said that was him. But, and you think, wow, that happened? And I was surprised when I read this too. I was like, wow, that actually happened? Kosminski was picked? But the person who picked him was apparently a Jewish witness and apparently would not testify against Kosminski, and saying that he wouldn't testify against, quote unquote, a fellow Jew. And so they couldn't get this witness to testify against Kosminski, even though he picked him out in a police lineup as being Jack the Ripper. So they couldn't do anything with Kosminski. They couldn't hold him, even though they had arrested him. So they let him back on the street and they let him continue murdering, in my mind. Again, we have that chalk writing on the wall that apparently self-identified him as Jewish, and Kosminski was Jewish. And again, we have that later diagnosis that he indeed had paranoid schizophrenia, and he was locked up in an asylum later in around 1889, which is when the murders stopped. To me, there's just so many things that line up with Aaron Kosminski way more than any other murderer. But again, none of it is definitive, and anybody can have any, they can think anything. And again, like I said, if you just change one assumption, maybe Aaron doesn't work. Maybe the more likely suspect is Chapman. You just really have to come to your own conclusions on these ones. But personally, I do think Aaron Kosminski does have the highest probability in my mind of being Jack the Ripper. And a lot of people online, and I know it's not very contrarian of me to say Aaron Kosminski, because I think through the research, most people, most Ripperologists would say Aaron Kosminski. A good proportion of them at least would say Aaron Kosminski. Well, folks, with that, I will draw this episode to a close. The case of Jack the Ripper is ungodly levels of famous, and still with all of this attention, a suspect has never really truly been pinned down. Unfortunately, a lot of the firsthand police files and reports that would be invaluable to Jack the Ripper research were burned up and destroyed in the bombings of London in World War II. If we had all the facts together, and like I said, if the police weren't so dead set on their assumptions back then, maybe we could have a definitive culprit. But for now, all we can do is diligent research to come up with our best educated guesses at who could have possibly been Jack the Ripper. Thank you all for listening, and again, a second thanks to those of you who have stuck with me over this past month or so. I will be releasing episodes more regularly, but I do have a slight modification to the schedule. Instead of releasing an episode every Thursday, from now on, I will be releasing an episode every other Thursday. And I hope you guys can understand that these episodes take up a ton of time and effort, way more than I had originally anticipated, but I do want to keep the quality of the research high. In my mind, it's quality over quantity. So with that, be on the lookout for an episode in 2 weeks, and stay curious as always. See you next time.